this is Leslie Barfick-Henser, and this is Lot of Fat. Today I'm speaking with Dean Kathleen Guzman about wills. In this episode, I speak with Interim Dean Kathleen Guzman of the University of Oklahoma College of Law. Dean Guzman teaches estate planning and lectures on wills for Kaplan Bar Review. I found this conversation fascinating, mostly because I know little about wills. Dean Guzman explains that many jurisdictions have relaxed rules of will formality and allow holographic wills. I thought holographic wills were akin to some holograms, you know, like when they bring music stars back to life. But actually, holographic wills means holistic writing. You'll hear more about this in our podcast. And you'll also hear Dean Guzman recite some lyrics from the Rush song Free Will. So whether you're a student of wills or a music enthusiast, this episode is for you. And once again, I want to remind you that if you are about to take the bar or thinking about taking the bar, Kaplan Test Prep is offering you $100 off their test prep program. Just go to captest.com/bar-exam and put in code Leslie100 for $100 savings. And here's my discussion with Dean Guzman. Thank you so much for joining with me, and I'm so excited to talk about wills. It's a 2L, 3L class versus a 1L class. And the law I know is changing so much with new technology, but can you kind of start with some background and tell us what the requirements for validating a will are?
Sure. The requirements have traditionally been kind of intense, and it's interesting. The ability to write a will didn't really generate until about the middle or so of the 16th century, at least with regard to land. And so I'm suspecting that at the time, because of some evidentiary concerns and the fact that people were just starting to write documents, not just starting to write them, but starting to use documents more readily, and more people were able to read and write at that point in time, there was a concern about whether, you know, this written instrument that was going to purportedly transfer title to property after the death of the star witness, who could talk about it, had already died. And so, again, traditionally, the requirements were pretty intense. So you might need to, or you would need to have a writing, so a document that was written, that was signed, that had two witnesses, and oftentimes some other requirements would play out as well, like the requirement that the testator, who is simply the person who is writing the will, would be in the presence of the witnesses when asking them to sign the will. And it was just so super strict, and the law really jealously guarded those rules. And again, certainly an important component of that was because the person whose intent it was would already have been dead, would already die by the time the document was being even offered into probate, or someone was trying to figure out whether it was indeed a valid will and it represented that particular decedent's last wishes.
I'm picturing the scenario where you have a woman and she has children by her first marriage and a husband by her second marriage. The woman executes a will and the woman dies, and now she left all her money to her second husband, and the children are fighting with the second husband. And since the woman is now dead, she can't say what her intent was, and she can't prove that she
exactly
signed this document, right? Okay, got it. So
exactly.
You say, so I mean, it's not funny, but you know, that's the classic. So you say that it was so strict. Have the rules relaxed over time?
Well, they definitely have, and in a couple of different ways. So one means of relaxation, perhaps, if you want to think of it that way, is it's also just simply a different way to execute a valid will, is that many jurisdictions, largely for populist reasons, decided that they were going to recognize a so-called holographic will. So someone could write a document, and at least under its original iteration, if that document was entirely in the handwriting of the decedent and dated and signed, that might work as a valid will without any witnesses whatsoever. So it was thought of as cheaper and easier, and it certainly was a method of will making that relaxed some of the stringency of the, you know, again, the mid-16th century and its view of the will. So some people think about that as a relaxation. I certainly do. It's much cheaper and easier to make a will that way, Leslie.
Mm-hmm.
But even further than that, the the law kind of came in and moved away from what had originally been a really strict view of a will and the formalities demanded of it and the compliance with those formalities met. So strict compliance resulted in all kinds of interesting scenarios where a mistake, maybe it was a slight mistake, maybe it was a big mistake, but some sort of mistake would completely invalidate the will, no matter how slight it was. And that led to some really concerning results where people who clearly had intended to die testate or die with a valid will ended up dying intestate without a valid will. And then we're just kicking it over to like the state legislature to decide where our property goes at death. And for a lot of people, that's a very scary proposition.
Right. So I guess I'm going to quickly ask you this because I do not teach wills. I'm not that familiar with wills. What are the basic bottom line requirements that the testator must meet to make the will valid?
Well, if it's a witnessed or attested will, the basic requirements are that it must be in writing and signed and witnessed by two witnesses. Mm-hmm. If it's the easier holographic will, then no witnesses are needed whatsoever. And depending upon the jurisdiction, there's some jurisdictional variation, but depending upon the jurisdiction, the requirement is effectively that either all or a material portion of that will must be in the decedent's or the testator's handwriting and then signed and sometimes dated. So the first method requires witnesses for purposes of, you know, evidentiary, avoidance of fraud, protecting the testator against imposition and ill-considered action. The second method, the holographic will, does not demand those witnesses at all. It simply allows testators to, you know, knock something out in theory within like 3 minutes. Mm-hmm. I could write a valid will, you know, in three or fewer minutes and not have to worry about some of those more stringent requirements. And so the holographic will is already more flexible and easier to accomplish than the attested or witnessed will. But what happened in probably starting in about the 1960s or thereabouts, there was this movement away from the super-duper strictness of writing a valid will, and a movement toward first what was called substantial compliance, which mm-hmm. sounds pretty good. You know, oh, you don't have to strictly comply, but if you substantially do so, good enough for us. And then even more recently toward what might be considered currently the most liberal, perhaps, I'm not sure, flexible perspective, which is called harmless error. And, you know, if you take that at its word, what harmless error basically is saying is that we don't care what the rules said and how strictly or loosely you complied with them. We will say it's a valid will as long as there's clear and convincing evidence that the decedent intended that writing or that document, depending upon the jurisdiction again, to be a valid will. And that's created some really interesting outcomes.
So I want to talk about the outcomes, but I'm going to take it a step back for just a second. First, I'm going to ask you to define what a holographic will is, because when you say a holograph, I think of, you know, Michael Jackson now standing on the fake screen.
So I have to admit, I kind of do too. Or I picture one of those little pictures that if you turn it sideways, it you know, changes.
Yeah.
But a holographic will, I like to think of it, and I don't know that this is completely appropriate from a, you know, etymological perspective, but graph, the word graph, graphic, graphia, I'm thinking about handwriting, mm-hmm. and hola, at the beginning, I'm thinking about holistic or whole. So holographic wills are generally, casually stated at least, wills that are in the decedent's handwriting.
Okay.
They don't require witnesses, they're just handwritten, and they've, you know, not every jurisdiction even recognizes them. About half of the jurisdictions do, but not every jurisdiction. In the other states, they say, hey, we're not going to give you that out. We're going to require all of the other formalities, the witnesses who have actually been in the decedent's presence or the testator's presence when the testator signed the will or acknowledged it or along those lines, and when they themselves sign the will often. And there are just more rules for the attested will, which means there are more ways to go south.
So that's so interesting. So if I go, and let's say I'm in a jurisdiction that that accepts holographic wills. And 3 years ago, I went to a fancy estate attorney and I wrote out my document and I signed it and I had two people sign it and we did all the things we have to do. And then last Tuesday, I hand wrote that I want to give all my money to the ASPCA and I stuck it in my drawer and I die. And somebody finds this handwritten document that's dated 2020. And they weigh that as against the 2017, you know, very specific document that met all the pre-holographic requirements. Does that mean that my handwritten document's going to prevail over the other one?
It does.
Wow.
It does. Now, there are other ways to challenge that will. I mean, and it's interesting because some people think, oh, you can only revoke a very formal will with a very formal will. But you can revoke a formal will with an informal, not with an invalid will.
Right.
That's a big mistake. But you can revoke a really formal document with an informal one as long as it's recognized within that particular jurisdiction. I mean, that's a big as long as, mm-hmm. but I guess another way to say it is once the law validates a testamentary method in a particular jurisdiction, then it treats all wills equally, so to speak, irrespective of the method that had been chosen. I don't want to mislead, however. You know, you could still challenge that subsequent will on some other basis, like lack of testamentary capacity or undue influence or lack of testamentary intent. Someone was just writing a little handwritten note and was not actually intending for it to be a will.
Mm-hmm.
So those other challenges remain, but the attempt is not going to fail for lack of validity. A very informal document can revoke a very, very formal one.
So getting to the validity, let's talk about some of the validity challenges, both pre-technology and really, more importantly, post-technology.
Well, here are a few examples. This is a real-life example, maybe one that I shouldn't necessarily share, but nevertheless, my grandmother, loved her dearly. She, for some reason, had this affinity for masking tape and markers. And when she wanted to, if she were still alive, she would be very disappointed that I was sharing this with you and those who might be listening. But if you were in trouble, well, if you were in her good stead, you kind of knew because she would take masking tape and she'd put it on an item. I remember once she put it on the bottom of her jewelry box. I don't know if she was just trying to tease me. And then she'd write someone's name on it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were in trouble, you would hear like the sounds like, and it usually meant she either ripped the tape off. Oh, I'm serious. This is like, we knew that struck fear into the heart of my sister and me. But she would, that either meant she ripped the tape off or she had ripped off a different piece of masking tape, put it on top of the old piece and would write a name on it.
Mm-hmm.
Someone else's name. So I was constantly checking underneath the organ and underneath her little poodle when I was little, because I, for some reason, thought I was going to find my name on Gigi the poodle's belly. It never happened. And she probably never would have wanted to rip that tape off because, you know, that would hurt the dog
as
make me sad. Right. But that would be an example of something pre-technology, obviously, all you needed was your marker and your masking tape, where it would definitely not be a valid attempt to make a will. Now, my grandmother might have meant it, you know, fervently. That might have been her fervent wish, hope, and desire. But because that piece of masking tape would not, if you're in a jurisdiction, for example, that requires witnesses to sign the will, that piece of masking tape would not have been witnessed. It would not have witness signatures on it. It would not itself reflect that it was intended to be a will. And so it would not work,
mm-hmm.
and it would not work at all.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you are in a really, really forgiving and flexible, modern, harmless error jurisdiction, and I think about maybe 11 or 12 states have gone down this path, the theory is even a piece of masking tape, even a piece of signed masking tape on the bottom of a jewelry box, we will say, could possibly suffice as a valid will, even without fancy lettering, the last will and testament of, I hereby declare this is my last will, as long as there were clear and convincing evidence that that testator, that person who made that effort, intended it to be a will. Mm-hmm. And if you take that to its logical extreme, you could have all kinds of, you know, seriously defective attempts being accepted, nevertheless, under, you know, the harmless error standard, if you had a jurisdiction or a court so inclined.
Right. Could you, so a couple questions. Could you articulate, like, is there, like, language that says this is the harmless error standard? Or
it's kind of just called the harmless error standard. It, mm-hmm. it finds expression. Well, it originated out of Australia. It started to experiment with it somewhat back in the, I think it was the 70s or 80s. The way that it's articulated is basically called either harmless error, and I can never say that word, I'm sorry, but harmless
okay.
error, harmless uh-huh. mistake, or the dispensing power approach. Mm-hmm. And it the UPC, the Uniform Probate Code, which is, you know, a uniform attempt, right. like the Uniform Commercial Code, or a uniform anything, but the Uniform Probate Code really started promulgating harmless error as a standard in 1990. Mm-hmm. And since then, so we're what, 30 years out, there was this gradual kind of, at first tepid, and then maybe a little bit more excited embrace of harmless error as a principle by different states over the past 30 years. So as I say, we have about 11 or 12 that have adopted it now, and it tends to be called the harmless error proposition. But you know what's baked in that. We all know what an error is. It's
right.
like when you fail to meet the legislative standard, but what makes it harmless?
That's the question.
You know, and
yeah.
sometimes that can be really tricky. That can be a really difficult thing to wrestle with.
So can you, I'm thinking about your grandmother and the tape underneath her jewelry box. If you were in a harmless error jurisdiction, could they get you and your sister, and maybe not you, but your sister and others, to testify that this was her way of showing who she intended to bequeath property to? And would that justify that was her intent?
Possible. I'll admit that the example that I gave you with my grandmother and the tape, even in the jurisdictions that have embraced the harmless error principle, that might be a bridge too far, at least currently. If there were clear and convincing evidence of my grandmother's intent, however, then at least in theory, mm-hmm. it would work. Mm-hmm. Now, what's going to be clear and convincing is its own interesting discussion, right? Because you know, my clarity might be someone else's confusion, or someone else's clarity mine. So there are all these words that are thrown about that, you know, don't necessarily give us clear, predictable, crystalline principles upon which we as lawyers, or as eventual decedents, because we will all, at least insofar as I know, we will all face our ultimate
nice.
demise, there aren't
we'll
clear signals about
we
what works.
Right.
What?
I said, and pay taxes.
I'm sorry?
I said, and pay taxes until
That's exactly right. Death and taxes.
Right.
So some of the past cases have been things like, maybe there was a witness who signed, but signed in the wrong place, or signed on some sort of affidavit, but didn't technically sign the will.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe there was a situation where the particular jurisdiction, you know, is really picky about what qualifies as presence when certain signatures are appended to the document,
mm-hmm.
And says, oh, well, presence isn't met if you have someone who is signing the document behind, like, one of those curtains at the hospital. So you're at the hospital, and someone's on one side, someone's on the other. People are giving other folks privacy, and it all too often happened, particularly under strict compliance regimes, that really hoped for testamentary outcomes were being thwarted because of some mistake in mm-hmm. the execution process or ceremony. And this harmless error doctrine at least gives an escape valve, assuming that the evidentiary burden is met.
So, so what about, instead of handwriting it, instead of, you know, meeting with an attorney, what if I email you my last will and testament? Just like as an email, you know, that's part of, I want you to know. Yeah.
Yes, and I think that's really where this is becoming a particularly acute question, because you have the confluence of harmless error as a doctrine and as a fairly forgiving one, at least in theory, abutting or hitting the screen of technological change. We live in what I tell my kids. I've got a 23, a 21, and an 18-year-old, and I say, wow, you guys live in such a casual culture, because they will do really what seem to me to be important things in Instagram or text or Facebook posts or email. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then they kind of do the little slap of the hand, kind of like brush, brush, okay, done, you know, done that, finished. Mm-hmm. If, for example, and I don't want to use them in these examples because I don't want to fathom the thought, but let's suppose that I were to write a text. Mm-hmm. And in my text, I were to say something like, I want you to, you know, I know you have always loved my Elvis Costello CD collection, and I want you to have my Elvis Costello CD collection when I die. All right. So if I wrote that in a text and then sent it, the problems that might surface modernly would be, look, it wasn't a traditional writing. Perhaps a lot of that depends upon how the term writing is defined and how the term document is defined, but it's not a traditional writing with a so-called wet signature. And I heard that phrase recently, and I thought, wow, that's really great, evocative, yeah. Because then I'm thinking about, isn't it? I can picture it.
Fabulous,
it's like
yeah.
pen and
the
ink. And,
yep.
Right.
Yep.
All of it. Yeah, that could smudge and, mm-hmm. and so on. So the problems with that attempt might be these. I truly intended for the person, whomever it was, let's suppose it's you, Leslie, I truly intended for you to have my Elvis Costello CD collection, but and I thought I had accomplished it when I pushed send. I thought, oh, you know, done deal, done deed, good to go, but that might not fly in the particular jurisdiction as a writing or as a signature, and it certainly would not be witnessed, and a question might arise whether I had even dated it. And then someone might say, well, we meet the dating concerns in jurisdictions that hold them, because you know, there will be a record of the date that it was sent and the date and time that it was received. But that would be an example where even heartfelt wishes of mine might fail to fly. Mm-hmm. And then if that jurisdiction also recognized the harmless error standard or the harmless error principle, it's at least possible, assuming it worked as a writing, it would be at least possible that it notwithstanding, you know, signatures of witnesses, we will say, because most people don't have others witness their texts or their emails, mm-hmm. It would still be a valid testamentary act. And if a jurisdiction were to go down that route, the jurisdiction is essentially saying that it wants to privilege intent over formalities, whereas in the past, the idea was always to privilege formalities over intent.
Right. So on an exam, then, it seems to me that the threshold question you have to ask yourself is what jurisdiction you're in, right? Are you in kind of the
Absolutely.
Traditional? And then if you're in the traditional jurisdiction, then you have to ask yourself kind of the litany of questions. Did they have witnesses and all of the things that go with that, correct?
Well, traditionally, for the attested or so-called witnessed will, generally a writing, a signature by the testator, and then two witnesses who also sign that document. And by and large, the jurisdictions say, at the request of and in the presence of that testator, that person who wrote the will. So on a test, if I saw any piece of paper, for example, and maybe modernly, if we're capturing technology as well, if I saw anything that I could argue could be converted to a piece of paper, like something stored locally, maybe on an iPad, and that was capable of being printed out subsequently, I would think, okay, what does this jurisdiction even recognize with regard to wills? Does it even recognize a holographic will, which need not be witnessed? That might be where I'd start. And then I'd say, you know, does it meet the requirements for either the attested or the holographic will? Yes, no. If I'm on an exam and it's an essay question, it's probably going to be ambiguous, and I'll say maybe. Mm-hmm. And then I'll say, you know, here's the standard. Maybe it's met, and here's why. Maybe it's not met, and here's why. Here's the policy of either approach. But, hey, I've got this back pocket principle that I can pull out, again, jurisdictionally dependent. Is this substantial compliance, even if it's not strict? Or is this harmless error, which is even more forgiving, mm-hmm. even if it's not substantial, mm-hmm. substantial compliance? And, mm-hmm. you know, it gives a lot of people a lot of things to talk about. And again, you don't have to say yes or no. All you need to do is talk about why and why not the possibility even exists.
Right. Interesting. Wow. You make it sound so clear.
Well, no. Oh, my gosh. I don't know how clear I make it sound, but I get so excited about wills. And I admit, I don't know what causes that excitement, but this sounds like such a corny thing, but I oftentimes think that will making, once the possibility even existed, because for so long people weren't even given the chance to write a will. You know, it was taken from them. Yeah. And so once that possibility kind of came about and said, yeah, we're going to let you write wills, and I might have screwed it up. That might not have been in the, I think it was the 13th century, at least with regard to land. But once that opportunity even arose, I think of it as almost feeling like a sacred act. I mean, if we go back far enough in time, oftentimes wills were literally deathbed enterprises. And so people, it was like their last wishes, and it might even, you know, tick in or be undertaken almost simultaneously with last rites. So kind of having a sacramental quality, if you will. And so I've often thought of wills as revealing the soul of the person who makes that particular will. You really get a window into that person's hopes and dreams and wishes and desires in a way that statutes that talk about what happens if you don't write a will give you a window into the hopes and wishes and dreams and desires of that entire community that has passed that particular piece of legislation. And so maybe for that reason, I just think it's fascinating.
Yeah.
And sometimes not as clear as it might seem when you read some of these cases and you think, oh my gosh, that person obviously intended that document to be a will, or obviously intended that document not to be a literal will, but the court goes the opposite way and does the opposite thing. It just creates difficulties. And I do think that this generation and the way that they're used to conducting business online and business through technology and communication through technology and so forth and looking for kind of quick and easy means of accomplishing these types of things could find themselves in difficult, sticky wickets, so to speak, because they translate that into this will-making arena and then don't even realize. Think they've done a will and don't even realize that you know, maybe harmless error will apply, maybe it won't. We don't really have enough law to answer that question with any great degree of clarity.
And just to go back to what you said at the very beginning of when we began speaking, is this idea that if you don't have a will, or if your will is not valid, then the state gets to decide how your assets are disposed. And, you know, so there's this fundamental principle of not, you know, making sure you have a will. And if you're going to go through the trouble of making sure you have a will, making sure that it's executed properly.
Yes. Yes, and that's, I mean, I'm of a couple different minds on that. The predominant mind, I guess, when I'm thinking about it most directly, is I personally don't want a state legislative body to be ultimately making the decision about where my property goes when I die. And yet, if I either don't make a will at all, or if I try to make a will but it is invalid, that's exactly what I end up with.
Right.
And so the extent to which, you know, there's a perfect alignment between what the state statute says, and they're usually called intestacy statutes or state statutes of descent and distribution, but the extent to which there's perfect alignment between what that statute says and what individuals would want, then one might say no harm, no foul, because you're going to get in what you want anyway, and you didn't even have to spend you know, invest the time and the other costs associated with estate planning. The state did it for you. It's a quote free will in effect. But again, that's really dicey because oftentimes we think we've accomplished something correctly and we don't realize that it didn't get the job done. And then upon death, there's no chance to go back and fix it.
Right.
There's this great song. I admit to being somewhat of a Rush fan. And one of the songs they sing, and I love this song because it works on so many levels.
I'm thinking because one of the members of Rush just passed away, so there you go. I hope he had a will.
I know. Neil Peart. And he was an amazing drummer.
Yeah.
But one of theirs, I'm a child of the 80s, perhaps, with regard to my musical tastes. But they have this song called Free Will, and they weren't talking about will making whatsoever, but the lyrics were so perfect because the lyrics basically at one point in the song, you can choose a ready guide in some celestial voice. If you choose not to decide, you still have made a choice.
Hmm.
And then it goes on and says, I will choose free will. I will choose the path that's clear. I will choose free will. And so some people might say, hey, people who don't write wills, they are choosing not to write wills, and therefore they are choosing what the state is, quote, foisting upon them anyway. So they're getting what they wanted anyway. I just think that when push comes to shove and people actually compare or think about what their own wishes might be mm-hmm. with what the state would give them, far more often than not, there's a fairly significant disparity,
mm-hmm.
and that's why estate planning is so critical, and that's why will making, which looms large within estate planning, notwithstanding things like trusts and life insurance policies and other forms of estate planning, that's why will making is so important. And yet, with people who do things kind of casually, might not be as accomplished as often as those people think.
Got it. Well,
good news.
Yes,
good news.
Yes.
Good news is that the Uniform Law Commission has just this past summer, just in July of 2019, passed legislation known as the Uniform Electronic Wills Act. I don't think it's been adopted anywhere yet, but states are thinking about this. There are about four states that have already passed some legislation. The first one, it actually sounds pretty early, 2001 or 2002 in Nevada, but it was revised in 2017. So 2017 to 2019, you have about four states that have ventured down this road. There are maybe four or so more where electronic wills legislation is under consideration. I think that's good news because as, the dialogue and the discussion gets out there, states will either deal with it legislatively, or perhaps there are opportunities for this harmless error, common law case-based approach to start getting some precedent such that maybe a little bit more predictability is available.
Hmm. Interesting. Wonderful. Well, you got it all in there, including quotes from Rush, so I really appreciate it.
I don't know that I did. I'm worried.
I know. No, you did.
Hopefully I got it in.
No, I think you did, and you certainly, listen, I learned it, so if I can learn it, then I think that our students can too. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us on this. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Leslie, very much.
Thank you.
And that's my discussion with Dean Kathleen Guzman, who talks about wills in this conversation and is also a lecturer for wills for Kaplan Test Prep. A reminder that if you're thinking about taking Kaplan Test Prep, you are entitled to $100 off from your test prep fee. Go to kaplanbarprep.com and type in the code Leslie100. Also, once again, if you could take a few moments and like us on Instagram or Twitter and rate us on any platform on which you listen to these podcasts, we'd really appreciate it. And as always, you can reach us at lawdefact@gmail.com. Have a good day.